Listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, broadcasting from the Cultural District here in cloudy Fairfield on this wonderful late August Friday. You're listening to Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully the rain is gone and we will see some sunshine now.
That's the plan.
There's a scientific word for all this stuff that's been going on. Weird.
Well, we have quite an exciting guest lined up for today. She's actually in Europe, and so we're having a little trouble making the connection. Hopefully we will get her on the line. But in the meantime, I'll
what
go ahead.
A prolific author, my goodness. And this book that we're going to be talking about is Mrs. Lincoln, and it's just really something.
Catherine Clinton is the author of Mrs. Lincoln. That's her most recent book. She's also the author of Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom, which was named as one of the best nonfiction books of 2004 by the Christian Science Monitor and the Chicago Tribune. And she's written quite a number of other books, including some fascinating children's books. She was educated at Harvard, Sussex, and Princeton, and is a member of the advisory committee to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Bicentennial Commission.
Wow.
And she currently holds a chair in U.S. history at Queen's University in Belfast, Northern Ireland. So that's just a tidbit.
Yeah, just
of
a little bit,
of
just
her
a
background.
Tiny bit of her background. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of her other books that she's written include The Plantation Mistress, Woman's World in the Old South, Portraits of American Women, Half-Sisters of History, Southern Women in the American Past, and just it goes on and on. Fanny Kemble's Civil Wars, which is a really fascinating looking book.
And it's one their life during the Civil War.
So Catherine, can you hear us? Are you with us?
Catherine?
Okay. Hold on. Let's try. Catherine, can you hear us? Catherine? Okay, we're going to... Oh, there we are. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
We've just been telling our listening audience...
It's wonderful to hear you.
We've been telling our listening audience a little bit about your background, which is...
Very impressive.
Well, give a shout from Belfast. That's what we do here in Belfast.
You give a shout. Okay. So let's start from the end. How did you come to be in Belfast?
Well, I had been writing full-time for many years and taking visiting positions since I had retired from teaching at Harvard in order to pursue writing full-time, and I had two young children at the time, and one thing led to another, but as you know, children grow, and the point of parenthood is planned obsolescence, but there are always students eager to learn more about American history, and very luckily, I was able to secure a chair in U.S. history at Queen's University Belfast at a time when there was an expansion of interest in U.S. history in U.K. universities, and also a very historic time in Northern Ireland. A lot of my work had been on the Civil War and on policies of reconciliation and issues of race and conflict, and so it was quite tempting to think about coming to Northern Ireland at a time when they were moving forward and coming together, and it was just a really exciting challenge. So in 2006, packed my bags and came over to Belfast.
And for those of us who aren't maybe real familiar with the academic community, what does it actually mean to hold a chair at a university?
Well, you have different positions, and I guess a chair position is, I think, as high as you can get on the scale, in that you move up from being a lecturer to a senior lecturer, a reader, and then a professor. And if you're given a chair, that is I think an honor. So I was very pleased to be so honored. And to think that American history was going to be taken very seriously in a new era of change.
Mm-hmm.
Because, interestingly, the American Civil Rights Movement was something that self-consciously many people in Ireland had modeled a movement for equal rights in Ireland, and indeed the lessons of American history were ones that many people in Ireland looked to. So it was something I took quite seriously. I'd written on Ella Baker and other black freedom fighters, so I was quite interested in seeing how some of these parallels might play out. But it's only quite recently that U.S. history has come on the radar. I actually did a master's in American studies at the University of Sussex in 1974, so it was interesting to come back.
Wow.
And see where American studies was in the U.K., and I can say that it was doing quite well, but actually since 2008, we talk about the Obama bounce. The interest in American history seems to have increased.
That's great.
And, of course, an interest in what makes America so distinctive and so special, and I suggest that issues of race and issues of gender are really quite significant, and these are the topics that I write about in American history.
Now, Catherine, looking through...
People make American history interesting, but that makes all history interesting.
Looking through the list of books that you've written, it looks like you've written that you've published a book almost every year for quite a long time.
Well, I did, as I said, when you give up teaching and you have a lot of enthusiasm for your subject, I was able to actually broaden my horizons, I think. I did begin to write for children. First, I worked on a K through 12 textbook, and then I became interested in seeing the way history was being taught to my own children, the way history was being presented in the textbooks, and it disturbed me to think about those of us sitting in our ivy-covered offices in great historical institutions who weren't getting the word out, who weren't getting the stories out into the wider public, and especially into schools and curriculum. This is quite exciting, and I've been working for the past decade with the Gilder Lehrman Institute in New York City, and they have lots of initiatives to broaden American history and increase its appreciation in American schools. So, for example, early next year, I'm going to be talking to
primary school teachers about how you can get history, American history, into the classroom and integrate it for very young readers. So I did do some historical works for young readers, as well as, of course, I hope, some trade biographies for all readers.
I saw two of your children's books on the HarperCollins website that were published by
right.
HarperCollins, and they look like they're beautifully illustrated and fascinating stories that children would really be interested in. I was very curious about the one when Harriet met Sojourner.
Yes.
Harriet
yes.
Tubman and Sojourner.
Well, it's
Truth.
Interesting because I wrote children's books, as I said, in the early 90s, and what I discovered was that Harriet Tubman, who I think was one of the great freedom fighters of American history, such an exemplary character, such an amazing life story, and although at the end of the century, the 20th century, there were a dozen children's books on the subject, the last serious biography of Tubman had been done in the 1940s.
Wow.
And this so shocked me, and I began to think about how we needed to lift the story of the Underground Railroad, and especially this remarkable woman, to a level to where she was put where she belonged in the pantheon of American heroes. So I did do a major biography of her, which appeared in 2004, and then I was besieged by people interested in doing children's books, and so I succumbed to my wonderful editor, and I had a great, beautiful illustrator, and I thought, why not put a book out there? And it all started when someone started talking to me about Harriet Tubman, and they were actually describing Sojourner Truth to me. So I realized that people were mixing up Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. And there were, of course, many more than two exciting, exemplary African-American women in the 19th century. But since they were, I think, such remarkable women, and there was no record of their meeting, but there was an actual meeting that took place in the middle of the Civil War, I thought it would be exciting to imagine that and to imagine their meeting and their respect for one another, each in her own way, doing her own work to promote greater freedoms, both for women and for African Americans. So I took the story and I hope injected it with a little bit of humor and appreciation for young children's interest in friendship and interest in difference, the very tall, the very short, the woman who worked by night, and the woman who spoke out in public. So I tried to compare and contrast these two genuine heroes of American history.
Now, Catherine, as a historian who's writing for the general audience, how much of your own imagination are you able to put into these stories? Do you rely largely on reported accounts and documentation?
Well,
but do you extrapolate
very seriously that we don't dumb down our stories for children. So we look at the fact that when I was writing a biography of Harriet Tubman, we had some verifiable accounts, we had documents, but Harriet Tubman herself left no diary or letter. She was illiterate. So we have to take secondhand accounts and secondhand reports. And as an historian, you weigh your evidence and you look at things and you do, in some cases, use imagination. I will say that for my children's books, I have created some dialogue, which I would not do for my adult biographies, nor the books I write for Oxford University Press and other serious academic ventures. But that doesn't mean I think that we should not try and be creative and not try and bring in the rich stuff of history that we're discovering in order to embellish our stories with what I think is really fascinating material. We can now, in a way, color and enrich our stories, whereas when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, the idea that you could tell the story of slaves through their own words in the WPA narratives or through artifacts like the cowrie shells that women wore, and try and describe from photographs of ex-slaves taken in the immediate aftermath of war what their lives were like. We have all sorts of new creative tools, and I try and bring them to bear on doing all kinds of work for adults and for children.
Well, let's turn to your most recent publication, Mrs. Lincoln. What drew you to this subject?
Well, for many years I had belonged to the Lincoln Soldiers Institute at Gettysburg College, and the Lincoln Prize was a very prestigious, outstanding prize in our field, and I'd heard so many authors talk about Lincoln, and I was well aware during my involvement with the U.S. Presidential Bicentennial Commission for Lincoln that so many books were being written about Lincoln. He's the most written about figure in American history, yet I noticed that in this great ramp up to the bicentennial, there was one figure who seemed to not only be forgotten, but really very much trampled, and that would be Mary Lincoln. And I thought it would be a real shame, since the last biography of Mrs. Lincoln appeared over 20 years ago, that we didn't try and take a new look at Mary Lincoln, not just in light of some of the new scholarship that has emerged, but also in light of what I think are her neglected accomplishments, especially in shaping her husband's political career that enabled him to become the president who was able to have such a powerful legacy during the war and then following his tragic death. So I thought that Mrs. Lincoln was deserving of at least one book in this great revival of interest in Lincoln, which has gone on in the bicentennial year.
I see that.
So I began to think about how I would want to shape it and what kinds of work I would like to do. So I tried to emphasize her later years, and I did travel to some of the places in Europe where she lived, and I tried to think about how she tried to shape her own husband's legacy in the wake of his death.
Well, I noticed that you researched and found letters that they had written to one another early in their marriage, and when he was first in politics, and his political career was not always happy for him, was it? He had a lot of problems.
No, I think we tend to see him as such a triumphant figure, the victor in the war, but when we look back at his early political career, we see many setbacks, his mm-hmm. failed Senate races, his disappointment in the wake of his one term in Congress that he wasn't given a plum appointment. And yet we see that he was someone who honed his skills on the prairie, that he canvassed his own home state of Illinois. He was always on the circuit. He was a great lawyer. I think the research done on the Lincoln legal papers in Springfield, Illinois, and elsewhere have really opened up a whole new vision of Lincoln. And Lincoln the lawyer was someone who got many of his cases and his connections through being married to Mary Todd from Kentucky. Indeed, Springfield, Illinois was populated with a lot of Todds. John Todd Stewart became the mayor, and it was Mrs. Lincoln's connections that in many ways shaped his political connections early in his career, and I think in some way smoothed and paved his successes along the way. This is not to say in any way, shape, or form that Mrs. Lincoln was the politics or the brains behind the operation, but simply to say that I think we can see her not just being emotional yeast for him, but also being a passionate partisan advocate for him, was something that was truly central to his character during those years when he did have such setbacks in his battles with Douglas and in his defeat by having Lyman Trumbull go to Congress as senator before he was able to ever make his way back to Washington. So she was someone there fighting for him.
Well, I noticed that she had, of course, when they did get to Washington, then she was snubbed, partly because of her, perhaps at that time when the Civil War was imminent, of her Kentucky background, but also he was considered to be a backwoods person, and you know, which was so, it's so sad. I just hate it.
Well, he was the first president born outside of the original 13 colonies. He was a Western president. He was caricatured as being rude and uncouth and vulgar. Mm-hmm. Indeed, the man with an axe in his hand who had to make his own way. He was uneducated. Mrs. Lincoln had 10 years of formal education.
I know.
To what Lincoln himself said was his 1 year of formal schooling. Mm-hmm. So when he did usurp many Easterners who had high hopes for the executive mansion, and Mrs. Lincoln brought many of her relatives with her for the inaugural celebrations, there were many cold shoulders. Indeed, it was the women of the South in Washington who turned their backs on Mary Lincoln, who thought of herself as a Southerner, mm-hmm. as a daughter of the bluegrass. She had aristocrats in her family, ambassadors, senators. She was someone who thought that she came from a slaveholding and a wealthy planter dynasty. And here she was arriving in Washington and having these Southern women, because of the erupting sectional divide, snubbing her, as you point out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had a tough time. Well, I think she was treated terribly her whole life, tell you the truth. I just, you know, with her father's will and her brother's, you know, challenging that, and they had a terrible time. And you know, Lincoln
like
was...
Like all families.
Yeah, like
she
all
came
families.
From a family
right.
where her mother died when she was quite young,
mm-hmm.
and left with small children. Her father, Robert Todd, sought a new wife who then provided him with 8 more children. So indeed,
oh.
Mary every year felt the family growing and herself being pushed out,
mm-hmm.
which is why she ended up in Springfield in her sister's home.
Right.
She was a belle in Springfield. She attracted a lot of attention, and her wit and her brightness was something that attracted Lincoln to her when he first met her in her brother-in-law's parlor.
Now, why did she choose him?
Well, I think that there's a lot of mystery about their courtship. You did mention that we do have some letters, but not particularly from that period. Actually, their relationship was quite murky. We know that they met sometime in the late 1830s. We also know that many people felt that they had become smitten and were even engaged. Then there was a falling out between the two of them after the fateful first, the New Year's Day in 1841. And for a period of nearly 18 months in the small town of Springfield, it seems as if they avoided one another quite steadfastly. Lincoln fell into a terrible depression. He had to go off and try and recover himself. He went to his friend Joshua Speed's home in Kentucky and then came back. And here was Mary Todd, seemingly in limbo. She had come to Springfield seeking her own company, seeking other suitors, and she seemed stuck on Lincoln. And when they did finally get back together in the fall of 1842, they very quickly decided to marry. Indeed, in such haste that it has caused several scholars to, I think, make suggestions about the nature of their impromptu wedding that are unwarranted. I don't believe that it was prompted by fears of pregnancy, but rather that her family might interfere again with what they considered a very unsuitable choice. Some of the Todds had said that Lincoln was no better than the dirt floors that his family came from.
So was that the cause of the falling out? Was family pressure from her
side? Don't really know. We do know that there was some kind of altercation that Lincoln felt he was unable to provide for Mary in the style to which she was accustomed, and he was going to withdraw, but there was an incident between the two of them. Different scholars have suggested a variety of scenarios, that she dumped him, that he tried to separate from her. We do know there were tears. We also know that she apparently did not take well to this falling out. But it is also true that during that period she remained in Springfield, and clearly she decided that Abraham Lincoln was worth waiting for. And when they were married in November of 1842, she left her sister's home high on Aristocracy Hill and moved into the Little Globe Tavern, which was all that Lincoln could provide for. And it was probably one of the smallest rooms she'd ever been in since her boarding school days. And she gave up a lot to marry him. But he was someone who seemed to, in many ways, appreciate her striving, her ambition, her devotion, and I do believe that despite some differences in their temperament, they made quite a remarkable couple.
Well, her striving and ambition seem to have gotten her in trouble time and time again.
Indeed. Well, she was someone who mixed in politics, who voiced her opinion. She was often trying to nix some of Lincoln's connections. When he was elected president, she even tried to influence some cabinet appointments. And we have letters that she wrote to several of his advisors, advising on who should and should not be advanced and put forward.
And this wasn't...
She was quite passionate about someone named Norman Judd, who had been someone who she felt had blocked her husband earlier in his bid for the Senate. And she was determined not to see him advanced, and was able to speak to David Davis, one of Lincoln's advisors, and to suggest that when she had been on a trip to New York, Norman Judd's name was bandied about, and he seemed like someone whose corruption might taint her husband's sterling reputation, because she was playing on the notion that he was Honest Abe, and this was one of the ways he was earlier portrayed by his supporters and champions. She wanted to sail proudly into Washington. That was why she made a trip to New York before they went there for the inauguration, because she did feel that she was being put under scrutiny. She wanted to prove herself. She also knew that all eyes would be upon Lincoln. Would he be able to hold the Union together during the perilous time of the spring of 1861? And shortly after the inauguration, we find the Union begins to dissolve, that secession becomes a reality, and eventually war is declared. So there's Mary Lincoln in her triumphant moment as the First Lady of the land, and soldiers are being bivouacked in her home. And her husband is calling up soldiers. And her very own brothers and half-brothers are entering into the war to fight against her husband's government. I mean, that's a really amazing crisis. I don't think we really have any historical parallels to that.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Catherine Clinton, the author of Mrs. Lincoln. Catherine, what are some of the common misperceptions about Mrs. Lincoln?
Well, I do think that she's often portrayed as someone... Let me say, the question I often get out on the road is, was she crazy? And I do think that this characterization of her as being mentally unstable, especially from her youth, there are several scholars who characterize her as being... genetically predisposed for mental illness, and or bipolar as a young girl, and unstable throughout the marriage, well into her White House years. And I think this kind of characterization is not warranted, that if we look at her as a young matron in Springfield, we can see that she very cleverly tried to maneuver her husband into a position of stability and power and respectability, that she went to Washington with him when he was elected to try and politic for him. That didn't backfire because she was in a small tavern boarding house with two young children, but we can see that she was someone who was quite clever and quite ambitious, as I mentioned before, and I don't think that she would have accomplished as much as she had if she had been this woman subject to the vapors, which I think is a misperception of her.
Uh-huh. How did it...
She did, of course, suffer some severe setbacks, the death of her child, Eddie, in 1850, and this losing a child, the first of three sons who would predecease her, was a terrible blow. The death of her son Willie when she was in the White House and her deep and prolonged mourning were quite debilitating. And then, following the terrible tragedy of her husband's assassination, she was a witness to that assassination. She was there with her husband's lifeblood seeping out, and I actually begin my biography with that because I think it's important to see that she was a tragic figure who was pushed out of her husband's life, and she's been pushed out of his legacy.
Mm. How did it come about that she was the first president's wife to be known as the First Lady?
Well, there were periods when there was no one to serve in this role as hostess in the executive mansion, and the young woman who had served before Mary Lincoln was Harriet Lane, James Buchanan's niece, Buchanan being the only president who had never been married. He was the bachelor president. And so someone in the press used the term First Lady, and then when Mary Lincoln became the mistress of the executive mansion, and she was someone who did try and really change the protocol. She did try and change the style and temperament. First of all, she was the first wife to come to Washington with young children for many, many years, and this was something that she had to manage her own family, her own household, and the center of power, and also the symbol of the Union that needed to be held together and restored. She was there managing levees and state dinners. She did try and open up the White House, something she was criticized for. She didn't want to just have private state dinners, but rather larger gatherings. It was something that came from her Springfield days. For anyone who goes out and visits the wonderful historic site of the Lincoln home in Springfield, you'll be shocked to know that Mary Lincoln invited 300 people to visit that home. People had to just flow through. And the same thing happened when she came to the White House and tried to invite almost all of Washington to come in and see beautiful tableaus, beautiful ice sculptures, and to really open up the White House to keep festivities going, which she was severely criticized for. Here were young men dying on the field, and here was the White House having festivities. But she thought it was important to continue the tradition of making the White House the center of the great nation, which her husband was trying to maintain and restore.
So no matter what she did, she was criticized. If she hadn't done anything, if she had been a recluse during that time, you know, she would have been criticized for that. So,
well, there was a period where she was quite reclusive, and indeed she at one point asked the Marine Band not to play concerts and was criticized for that because the people needed their music. She was someone who did go to the hospitals to write letters for young men who were ill, to bring flowers, to bring fruit, to bring supplies to the Washington hospitals. One of the Lincoln secretaries criticized her for not taking members of the press with her and to not trying to, in a way, showcase her volunteer activities, her philanthropic side. that this needed to be something that needed to be gotten out. The word needed to be spread in the Washington papers. But Mary Lincoln found very early on that she was going to be a lightning rod for the press. Indeed, it was said that whenever she left the executive mansion, the telegraph would trill with news of her every move. And I think it was one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't. I suggest in my book she was one of the first ladies to be hounded by the paparazzi, followed everywhere.
If she had taken the press with her to the hospital, they probably would have criticized her and said she was just doing it to make herself look good.
Right. Well, she did have the terrible burden that she was a Southern-born woman. She was related to many members of the Confederate Army. Wow. Her husband was extremely fond of one of her younger sisters, Emily. They called her little sister. And his affection for her husband, Ben Helm, who was the son of a former governor of Kentucky. And again, Lincoln was a Kentuckian, and he asked Ben Helm to serve in the Union Army. He refused. He went off to fight for the Confederacy and died. And Mrs. Lincoln would have to, in a way, repress any of these feelings of sorrow in public that she had about losing family, losing brothers. And she was quite vociferous in her attacks and said they were the enemies of her husband. So my husband is my country was the spirit many women took during the Civil War. But the White House was, I think, the very symbol of a divided house at that time. Although it was united in spirit, you did have the situation that she was suspected. Her all of her posts was read, incoming and outgoing, because she might have been then accused of smuggling out state secrets.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
Now, Catherine, you mentioned that you start your book with the assassination scene and how Mary Lincoln was basically pushed out of her husband's by his bedside. She wasn't allowed to spend his last hours with him. How did that
all
happen?
All Victorian women, all wives in the 19th century, knew one of their most sacred duties was, of course, to see to the death of a loved one. That this was uppermost in the minds to preserve the health of your loved ones, and then if the inevitable came and they were dying, to see to them, to tend to them. This was so much a part of the culture, all novels and plays and the church and education of a lady all revolves around that. So imagine my stress and shock when I discovered that it was a circle of men who pushed her out of the room, and quite literally, it was Edwin Stanton who ordered her from the room and said that she should not be brought back. And when the Reverend pronounced his last prayers and everyone in the room knew Lincoln was dying, no one brought Mary Lincoln there for her husband's final moments. And that was something, I think, that really did push her over the edge, to see that her husband died without her there. And she was
How could they have been so heartless?
In quite a state of shock.
How could they have been so heartless towards her?
Well, she was someone who, again, did not want to accept that her husband was dying. The doctor at first tried to protect her from this news until they could get her oldest son, Robert, to come to the Peterson boarding house. But she did become periodically unhinged, sobbing hysterically, and was taken from the room by one or the other of the women there in attendance. But I just feel that we need to see her as a figure who was shoved aside. And although the new president, Andrew Johnson, said she could stay in the White House as long as she needed until she recovered, she spent over 30 days there because she really literally did not know where to go. She had a great sense of being set adrift by her husband's death. He was, as she said, her everything.
Well, in that culture, you know, women were very dependent on their husbands, and it didn't seem like anyone stepped up to really help her at that point.
Her other son was someone who had just the very day of the assassination returned home from war, and I suggest in my book that there was a deep alienation in the family at that time, because after 4 years of agitation, Robert was finally allowed to enlist in January of 1865. He didn't want to sit the entire war out. He finished college. He wanted to enter after his graduation in the summer of 1864. His father demurred to his mother's wishes, but eventually he did enter into the army, and I suggest this was a rift between the Lincolns, one which really caused a lot of, I think, uncharacteristically imbalanced behavior on Mary Lincoln's part in the spring of 1865, shortly before her husband was assassinated. They were, she was completely devastated by the idea that she would lose a third son, and she feared for Robert's life in the army, which was, of course, every mother's fear at that time, who had a son away at war. And Robert was a rather Todd-like son. It was said that he took after his Todd relatives, and I think this caused clashes between mother and son during this period. And Mrs. Lincoln sunk into depression with her husband's death and leaned quite heavily on her younger son, Tad, who became his mother's constant companion during the years following Lincoln's death. And then his quite sad, tragic death from a lung disease in 1871 really sunk her even lower in spirits.
Yeah. Catherine, would you like to
tragedy
read?
Tragedy upon tragedy in her life, culminating with her only remaining son, Robert, deciding that she might do harm to herself, and he decided in 1875 that her behavior was so erratic that she needed to be confined to a sanitarium. And there was a public hearing. She was declared mentally incompetent and confined to an asylum for a year, losing her custodial rights.
Do you think that she ever blamed herself because she was the one that wanted to go to the theater? Lincoln had said he did not want to go, and at least that was reported, but who knows?
No, because actually we also have evidence that she had a headache, that they had made a commitment to going, and that's why they went through such a long list of people. It was a time when earlier in the day the Lincolns had been out on a carriage ride, and Abraham had told his wife that they must make an effort to be happier because the death of Willie had made them so sad, and they had a future to look forward to. And I think they were, in that moment, thinking of themselves as public figures who wanted to lift the spirits of the Union. So going out to the theater was something, I think, that Lincoln actually loved going to the theater. His wife did as well. It was said when she was younger that she would often see a suitor as suitable because he loved the theater. It was something she always wanted to do. Imagine the irony of only wanting to marry someone who would take her to the theater and then having her husband shot dead in the theater. Wow. She never attended the theater again.
Wow. Catherine, would you like to read a section from Mrs. Lincoln for our audience?
Sure. Again, I do think it's one of the most dramatic and important moments. So I would like to begin with my opening scene. For most people, it was an unimaginable act. Abraham Lincoln was shot and would spend a long night dying. For his wife, Mary Lincoln, her worst nightmare had come true. Only hours before, she'd been sitting proudly by the side of her husband, the man who saved the Union. When they entered the presidential box at Ford's Theater, the audience had applauded wildly, welcoming the interruption for Hail to the Chief. After Lee's surrender just days before, the Lincolns felt a personal emancipation from the terrible curse of war. The president had been more carefree and animated than his wife had seen him in years, at least since their son Willie had died 3 years before. While watching the play, she had been clinging to her husband's arm and teasing him about what their companion in the box, Miss Harris, might think of them. Lincoln replied, "She won't think anything about it." Those words were his last as the evening dissolved into chaos, noise, and blood. Mary kept recalling with horror the moment of the audience laughter masking the report of the pistol. She at first could not understand what was happening when the demon emerged from the shadows, slashing out with a knife before leaping onto the stage. Everything went out of focus except the vivid image of her husband's head slumped forward on his chest, his limbs slack in his rocker, and the blood. Once she saw the blood, Mary began to shriek, "They have shot the president." I'll move on. This was the moment she had fearfully imagined for so long, that she might lose this man who was the length and breadth of her, the very core of her. Mary's very marrow was indistinguishable from her marriage, and now this unbelievable loss plunged her into an abyss. She lost all that in a long and terrible night. How could Mary Lincoln have been so cruelly treated at such a time? The trauma of her husband's murder while they sat together, her gown splashed with blood, was terrible enough. But the way in which she was shoved aside at this crucial moment compounded her trauma, deepened and widened her grief, foretelling indignities to come. Her subsequent maltreatment, both real and imagined, contributed to her steady decline. From the time of her husband's assassination in 1865 until her own death 16 years later, Mrs. Lincoln failed to recover from the pain and loss of that night in the tiny bedroom at Peterson's boarding house. On her own, she would mourn in 1871 the death of her youngest son, Tad, the one reason she claimed that she did not take her own life following her husband's death. Next, she suffered an embittering alienation from her only remaining son, Robert. Mary Lincoln's sanity, as well as her character, had become a matter of lively debate. The scholars continue to wrangle over her life and legacy. Even her name has become contested terrain. The majority who write about her characteristically refer to her as Mary Todd Lincoln, yet she never used this name herself. Lincoln's wife was proud to have been born a Todd, and contemporaries would acerbically suggest she was a snob about her pedigree. Born into an aristocratic Kentucky family, she was given a superior education. Mary had nearly a decade more formal education than her husband and went to school many more years than the average male in America. As an alluring young belle with impeccable connections, there was every reason to believe Mary would have made a great match like two of her siblings. Her older sister had married the son of the governor of Illinois, while a younger sister married the son of a governor of Kentucky. But after a few false starts, Mary wed her Springfield lawyer, Abraham Lincoln, a man of humble origins whose main recommendation was his intellectual promise. The promise of peace electrified the American people. Bonfires were lit and bells rang as delirium reigned through the North, especially in Washington City. The victory secured the presidential couple enjoyed a carriage ride alone on Good Friday, April 14th, discussing plans for foreign travel. Lincoln wanted Mary to try to be happier. After all they had been through, both remembering the loss of their son Willie in 1862. Later that evening, Mrs. Lincoln had not felt like going out to the theater, hoping to stay home to avoid a headache, but she did not want to disappoint her husband, who intended to occupy the presidential box at Ford's Theater. She and her husband left the White House that night with high hopes for enjoying the comedy, as well as the pomp and cheer that accompanied them now. But Mrs. Lincoln would return home without her husband on Easter Saturday, a widow. The nation would heal and be reborn, but Mrs. Lincoln would never recover from her husband's assassination. Her story is bound up with the story of the nation, with the story of her husband's presidency, but her own story remains singular and remarkable. She was one of the first American women in the White House to capture the public imagination and to maintain a historical reputation into the present. It was Mrs. Lincoln who was the first wife of a president labeled First Lady, and it was by this role that she gained her lasting fame. When she whispered to her husband that night, wondering what would be thought of her, little did she realize what a defining moment this question would mark.
Thank you. That was Catherine Clinton reading from her biography, Mrs. Lincoln. And you're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM, Fairfield, Iowa.
As you can see by listening to that, she takes you, you are there.
Yeah.
Which is why this is such a great piece, because you really feel like you're there and you feel what Mrs. Lincoln felt.
Catherine?
Well, I do at times try to step back and try to give some insight into why she was such a controversial person. She could be quite cutting. She could be quite vain. But I think all of these flaws make her even more intriguing. And I hope that people will try and judge her by her own words as well as her deeds.
Catherine, how long did you work on this project? Catherine?
Yes.
How long did you work on this project?
Well, I did start, as I said, with an interest in the Civil War and with an interest in Lincoln through many of my fellow biographers in the field and many people working on Lincoln. So when I was finishing my biography of Harriet Tubman, I was trying to imagine a subject that might be as rewarding, that might be as challenging. And again, it was this subject of Mary Lincoln. There had been a very intriguing dual biography of Mary Lincoln and of Elizabeth Keckley, who had been the African-American woman who served as her dressmaker and confidant. And this got me thinking about how a full biography of Mrs. Lincoln was something I needed to think about. So I began, as I always do. You mentioned it seemed as if I was working on a book a year. It's not really that way, but I do try to overlap projects. I think it's hard to say goodbye to some projects, and actually I joke and say that it was very hard for me to let go of Harriet Tubman, who was such a comfort, but Mrs. Lincoln didn't give me much comfort. She was a very disturbing figure to wrestle with for the 5 or 6 years that I was working on the biography.
Wow. Now, do you do all the research before you start writing, or are the two processes intermingled?
I think they have to be intermingled. I found this out, that sometimes you would have a structure. In my one of my earlier biographies, you mentioned Fanny Kemble's Civil Wars, and I found it difficult because at one point I was considering writing about Fanny Kemble and her two daughters, one who sided with the Union and one who was a passionate neo-Confederate. And then I found that doing a biography of three women entangled was much too entangling, and so I stepped back and I found that I had to make the plantation that Fanny Kemble had lived on and then her daughter had later inherited was something that it had to become a character. So although I had been writing the book, I had to go back and do more research on the place. And I do feel that when I started my book on Mary Lincoln, I went to Springfield first in the fall, then in the winter, then in the spring. It was important to physically be there. And as I was working on it, different things emerged. Some new letters appeared. It's always exciting, I think, when you're working on a topic, when something appears that could very much change your interpretation. I found it intriguing that the new letters, which were we knew about, but they had disappeared, were letters written by Mrs. Lincoln when she was incarcerated.
Oh, wow.
And I think they very much confirm that she did not suffer from the levels of imbalance that have been attributed to her, because I found them quite persuasive and solid letters. My colleague Jason Emerson, who found these letters, copies of them, suggests otherwise in his book, The Madness of Mary Lincoln. So it's also exciting to find new material, and yet scholars are going to continue to clash and debate in their interpretations.
How do you organize all of the material, the stories and the references and the quotes and the letters? How do you keep all that organized as you're writing?
Well, I began by trying to have a database where I would try to take all the material written about Mary Lincoln and organize it according to when it was written, because so much of the Lincoln material is recollection. So much of the base of evidence we have about Lincoln and his life were testimonies given after his death. We do know, for example, one of the severest blows, public humiliations for Mary Lincoln was during the period when she was trying to establish herself as first widow, and her husband's former law partner did research and suggested that Abraham Lincoln had always been in love with another. And therefore, his Ann Rutledge story was a speech he gave. And so I tried to go back and look at pieces of evidence to see when and how this legend began, when and how Ann Rutledge was introduced into the story, to see if one could perhaps find new material in that very great pile of myth and mystery and debate. But what I found was that that there will always be a lot of debate over Lincoln, and some of us may never be able to establish truth beyond a shadow of a doubt, whatever that might mean. But I think I was persuaded that by going out and talking with other Lincoln scholars, which I did, I was very grateful that Doris Kearns Goodwin was willing to share with me, and David Herbert Donald, who'd been a great friend of mine when we taught together at Harvard and had always been very kind towards my ambitions for working on Mary Lincoln. When he published his prize-winning Lincoln biography in 1995, he was always asked, as authors are, what do you regret? What would you like to redo? What would you do differently? And he suggested that he would have given more time and attention to Mary Lincoln, which was something that made me think more about going back in and trying to dig around and find more material and try to think about, as you point out, being in the scene, how would Mary feel at a particular point in time? And this gave me some insight into the way in which their marriage might have worked differently from the way other scholars suggested.
Well, Catherine, we are about out of time. I just want to thank you for being on the show. This is a fascinating subject, and I assume that people can obtain this book at Amazon.
They can. Of course, I always tell people, since my aunt was a owner of an independent bookstore, that you can go into your local bookstore and ask them to supply Mrs. Lincoln, but it's true that you can go online, and it's at fine bookstores, we hope, everywhere, and will be throughout this bicentennial year when we're celebrating our 16th president and his legacy, a legacy Mrs. Lincoln spent her life burnishing.
We have some great independent bookstores here in Fairfield, and we do encourage you to look for to ask for Mrs. Lincoln there.
And people can go to my website, www.catherineclinton.com. And, of course, they can come over to Belfast, where we've got some great bookstores. And
now, there's an idea.
Students. We have wonderful exchange programs with Queen's University Belfast, and we're building up a reputation with our master's degree in U.S. history.
Well, congratulations on all of the above, and thank you for being with us on Writers' Voices. That was Catherine Clinton, author of Mrs. Lincoln, and we will close today. Mom, do you have a quote for us?
Yes, I do. Through the ages, we have seen that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, but not, I think, in the case of Abraham Lincoln.
See you next week on Writers' Voices. Thank you.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.